Everybody knows the deal is rotten. Old Black Joe still picking cotton for your ribbons and bows. Everybody knows that the dice are loaded. Everybody rolls with their fingers crossed. Everybody knows the war is over. Everybody knows the good guys lost. Everybody
welcome to the Lifeboat Hour, December 14, 2014. And as most of you know, this show has existed for about 4 years. And we're going into the fifth, and I was graciously entrusted with this show in April of this year with the passing of our dear friend Mike Rupert. And I love coming to you every Sunday night and bringing to you these wonderful guests. And sometimes I don't have a guest. Sometimes I just like to talk. But today we do have a guest. And the tradition of this show has always been to provide a beacon of light and sanity in turbulent times when so few such places exist in our world. We endeavor to bring you quality guests who offer us new and refreshing perspectives for viewing our predicament. And we certainly have one of those tonight. But before we get into conversation with our guest, I feel compelled to stop and notice that in the same week that the United States is being torn apart by the racial divide, its other shadow side, torture, is being exposed as never before. In an exclusive interview with Salon, Glenn Greenwald let loose and called it corrupt, toxic, and sociopathic. As I mentioned a couple of weeks ago on this show, the root of the racial divide in this country is the projection of white America's shadow onto people of color. Our torture practices are yet another face of this projection. And part of the projection process is the dehumanization that goes with it. And when we dehumanize people, then it becomes okay to do anything to them. This applies to systemic police brutality toward people of color, and it applies to torture of America's geopolitical enemies. I suspect that the torture topic is going to fade soon because it requires too much courage to look at the shadow and take responsibility for it. 99% of Americans would rather go shopping, and of course, this is the perfect time of year to do that. Nevertheless, I was so moved this week by these chilling revelations of America's shadow that I decided to begin my next book. My tentative title at this point is Mining the Gold in the Global Crisis, Healing the Human Shadow. I had a great conversation this week about this with my dear friend Andrew Harvey, who will be our guest next Sunday night, and I'm sure you'll want to hear our dialogue. I also want to mention that next Thursday night, December 18th, we will be concluding our webinar on relationships in the age of ecological apocalypse, and I'll be the final speaker in this series. We've had five others, and I'll be concluding the webinar with a topic, Ensconced in Eros, Bathed in Beauty, as we end this very rich and juicy course with a celebration of our aliveness and an invitation to create as much joy and beauty in our lives as possible, especially in this time of ecological apocalypse. To register for the last webinar session or to obtain the recordings for all the sessions, you may do so by visiting syncchast.net, and that's spelled S-Y-N-C-H-C-A-S-T. .net. We have a guest with us tonight who knows the territory of ecological apocalypse well, and who has worked very closely for a number of years with someone many of you are familiar with, Joanna Macy. For decades, Joanna has written and spoken passionately about our global crisis from an emotional and spiritual perspective in such books as Coming Back to Life, World as Lover, World as Self, Active Hope, How to Face the Mess We're In Without Going Crazy, A Year with the Poet Rainier Maria Rilke, and more recently, Coming Back to Life, The Updated Guide to the Work That Reconnects. Now in her 80s, Joanna still travels and lectures, but our guest tonight, Molly Brown, has worked tirelessly at Joanna's side for many years, and she comes to us tonight championing Joanna's work, which is the work that in some way most people listening to the show are doing on some level. Molly Brown combines eco-psychology, the work that reconnects, and psychosynthesis in her work, teaching online courses, writing and publishing books and essays, coaching and mentoring by phone and Skype, and giving talks and workshops internationally. With Joanna Macy, she co-authored the first edition of Coming Back to Life, the updated guide to the work that reconnects. And Molly's other publications include Growing Whole, Self-Realization for the Great Turning, Held in Love, Life Stories to Inspire Us Through Times of Change, and Lighting a Candle, Collected Reflections on a Spiritual Life. Molly lives in Mount Shasta in Northern California, and her work underscores one of my favorite topics, the connectedness of all life. Welcome to the Lifeboat Hour, Molly.
Thank you, Carolyn.
Well, you know, Molly, for many years, you and Joanna have been assisting people in coping with the horrific realities that confront our planet and our species, dire threats to democracy, to justice and peace, and to the continuance of life on Earth. Some people absolutely cannot live with the realities of our planetary predicament. And of course, as you know, they stay in denial or they alter their minds and moods with substances, or they kill themselves, or they just consume. What has been your experience with helping people move out of denial and into consciousness? And what do you see as people do this?
Wow, that's a good question. I think that people who are in denial are actively resisting what they really know. Mm-hmm. You wouldn't need to be in denial if there wasn't something to deny.
Yes.
In an alcoholic family, people, for example, may be in denial about the alcoholism, but underneath, somewhere inside, they know something terribly wrong is going on. And I think it's the same way on the planet today. The people are in denial, are kind of frantically in denial to avoid facing what we all need to face together. So the work that reconnects actually offers people opportunities to share what they really know deep inside in a group setting. And I think that's very important, because this isn't something we can do all by ourselves. Well, maybe some people can. Great meditators and so forth can probably do this on their own. But most of us need the support of other people, because, after all, the denial is sort of socially imposed, and so if we're a group of people who are not in denial, then we have more motivation and support in breaking through that. So it makes it socially acceptable, and it gives it support to do these very simple practices that we do in the work that reconnects, that helps people talk about what they really know to be true in happening in the world today.
Well, could you maybe, this sort of just came to me, could you maybe give us one example of one of those exercises or processes that people do?
Sure. One that's very, very simple, actually, and is also used in many different ways, is called open sentences. And people are in pairs, and the open sentences are suggested one at a time. And then the person who is speaking says the sentence and completes it, and then continues on for, you know, 3 or 4 minutes talking about that particular topic. And the other person just listens. And sometimes we'll go through 2 or 3 of these open sentences before we change who's speaking and who's listening. Or sometimes we go through each one, you know, back and forth and back and forth. So one such question would be, when I see what's happening in the world today, I think that...
Uh-huh.
So they're wide open. They're not aimed at anything in particular. except they're aimed at getting at what people see and know and also what people feel. So another one might be when I look at the world that we're leaving for our children and grandchildren, I feel blah.
Right.
And then the person continues. But I don't, they're never, you know, they're designed to help evoke stuff, but they don't ever, you know, point at a particular feeling or thought. It's pretty much open. So, and they can be used in all kinds of different ways. They can be used, for example, to evoke gratitude. Mm-hmm. So you could say, a place that I loved as a child was, you know, or
right.
someone who has really been a big support for me in my life is.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really a very wonderful technique because it's, you know, anyone could write some of these open sentences once you understand the principles. And it helps people then just begin talking about their thoughts and feelings.
Right. And I loved what you said about one of the very first things you said is that if we didn't know something on some level, we wouldn't need denial. And that is precisely why I chose our theme song for this program, Everybody Knows, because on some level, everybody does.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, our unconscious is a great receptacle for all kinds of knowledge that we, for one reason or another, don't allow into consciousness.
Absolutely. So, Molly, I'd like you to talk about the woman, Joanna Macy, and how you came to work with her. She's now 85 and is, in my estimation, one of the towering elders of our culture who sees more clearly than most people in her generation the landscape of suffering that is all around us and in front of us. So please say more about that.
Well, Joanna is, of course, a mentor, a sister, an elder, and a very good friend. I cannot think of what my life would be if I hadn't connected with her. I actually first met her in about 1986. I went to a event that was being held by a group called InterHelp that she had started, and she actually wasn't there the whole time, but she did come at one point. And she was very much the inspiration behind what was happening at this conference. So that was my first, even knowing about her. It was in 86. But then a few years later, I went to a workshop that she was giving on nuclear guardianship. And I came from Los Alamos, New Mexico. I grew up there. And so I have a sort of a karmic link to the issue of nuclear weapons and nuclear waste and nuclear energy and so forth, the whole issues, all the issues that are around that. So I was very intrigued with this workshop, and I went, and I think it was just a one-day workshop. It wasn't terribly long, but while I was there, I said, this lady is my teacher, and I'm going to do whatever I need to get next to her.
Right.
So I did. I joined her nuclear guardianship project and started going to meetings of that group. And then as the years have gone on, I initially took classes and workshops with her and then eventually started assisting her in various workshops and classes that she's taught over the years. And then, of course, in about 1996, I think, we started working on Coming Back to Life, the first edition of Coming Back to Life. And so that really cemented our relationship, because when you co-author a book, as you know, yourself know, it's a very close collaboration. It really connects you up with the person you're working with.
Yeah, it certainly does. And, you know, it can be kind of dicey because you don't know how that's going to turn out. And, you know, I wrote my first book this summer with somebody else. Guy McPherson and I wrote a book together. And I had never written a book with somebody. And I was really scared, to tell you the truth. It ended up being fabulous for both of us. But you never know, right?
No, you don't. And you really obviously need to be on the same page, on the
yes.
same wavelength. And, of course, when we wrote the first edition of Coming Back to Life, Joanna, you know, it's her work, and it was clear that I was assisting her in writing the book. And but in the intervening years, as we wrote the second edition together, the work has become more my own because I've been doing it. Mm-hmm. And therefore, we were more equal partners in the second book. But it's still Joanna's, still the root teacher. She's still the inspiration behind the work that reconnects. And I always enjoy learning from her as well as working with her on how to put this out in written form.
Now, tell us very specifically the title of the next book that's coming out that you co-authored with her, I believe, and that I gave an endorsement for. What is that book again?
It's called Coming Back to Life, and the subtitle, which was the title of the first one, but the subtitle, the new edition, is The Updated Guide to the Work that Reconnects.
Right.
And it is out already. It came out, I think, in November. So it
oh,
is
it did.
Out.
Okay.
Yeah, and it's New Society Publishers is the publication.
Great. Well, in your work with Joanna and with her writings, you speak of three stages of our time. Would you talk about those and explain in detail what you mean and what she means by the great turning?
The great turning is the possibility that in spite of all the threats that we have to life on Earth right now, that perhaps between now and whenever the Earth, life on Earth ends or collapses, or perhaps even beyond that, the possibility of a transformation in how we think and feel and how we live as a culture, as a society. We talk about moving from the industrial growth society, which is what we're in now, and industry and growth being the key words, to a life-sustaining society, and the possibility of that, as well as the very real possibility that that there'll be collapse. But you know, the two things can happen at the same time,
mm-hmm.
and even if life doesn't go on, in our remaining time, we could live a whole lot better and a whole lot more lovingly and compassionately and harmoniously.
Well, yeah, and you know, as you know, for the last 7 years, I've been writing about emotional and spiritual preparation for the collapse of industrial civilization and what appears to be the likelihood at this point of near-term extinction. My focus has been on the shift in consciousness of which you speak, and I'd like you to describe and define this as much as possible.
Okay, I failed to say on your previous question that the three stages of the Great Turning, or the three dimensions,
uh-huh.
are holding actions on defense of life. And that's where you go out and try and save a particular watershed, or you demonstrate against some particular, for example, the demonstrations that are taking place all across the country right now,
mm-hmm.
Concerned about police brutality and police killing of black people. Would be a holding action, is to try to change something that is happening that is not right. The second dimension is very closely related, and indeed it could be part of what the protests are about as well. We call it transforming the foundations of our common life, which is has sort of two parts. One is understanding, you know, understanding how is racism built into our institutions? And then how can we create alternative institutions to do a better job? So this is very, very foundational. It's not just reforming. It's actually transforming, which is a much bigger change. And then the third is what you've just referred to as a shift in perception and values. Without changing the way we think about who we are and how we relate to the larger world, to one another and to the natural world, none of the above will help. That is, we have to change the way we think and feel, as Einstein once said. I'm paraphrasing him wildly, but...
Sure.
So the shift in consciousness, actually, I have to say, Carolyn, you address this very, very well in all your books, at least the ones that I've read, to changing to an attitude of interconnectedness is the critical thing, that we really get it in our guts how interconnected we are, that we can't be looking out for old number one, because there is no old number one. There's only us. There's not I against
right.
us. And so a shift in perception and also values, valuing life above all else, certainly above profit and above money, which is not the way our industrial growth society operates. It does not operate in terms of putting life first. It puts profit first in so many instances. And you also in your books mentioned Viktor Frankl, Man's Search
yes.
for Meaning, as someone who, in the face of really horrific circumstances in a concentration or a death camp, actually, managed to find a way to live with meaning and purpose. It has to do with compassion, and it has to do with love, it has to do with gratitude for what we have, even in the most horrendous circumstances. There's always some kind of grace that we can recognize and embrace. And then connecting with our deeper self, the underlying unity that is beneath all our distinctiveness. And then also accepting death as I wouldn't even say part of life. I would say one with life.
Mm-hmm.
Life and death being two sides of the same coin is one way you can say it. That when we can do that, when we can accept loss and death and as just natural, we change the way we live.
Absolutely, absolutely. And appropriately, as we ponder the great turning of which you're speaking, Molly, we have a song from Portland vocalist Barbara Ford called The Great Turning Blues. Let's listen to it.
Let me tell you, children, about life here on Earth. We are faced with disaster from our moment of birth. The people who profit from all that they spoil, they mess with our future in the name of big oil. I-L-Oil. Our climate is changing, our wells have run dry, and millions must leave home just to survive. Injustice is raging in all of our lands. Shocking heads are debating while time slips through our hands. We've got the great turning blues. We've got the great turning blues. We've got the great, great turning blues. And all of the beings of water and land are paying the price now for the world that we have planned. The web is unraveling. All we do is we please. Then there's the people who have simply been taught that in order to live well, they must shop and shop and shop. Good-hearted people who have learned the wrong way. They've forgotten the future is created today. We've got the great turning blues. We've got the great turning blues. We've got the great, yeah, 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 great turning blues. So many people feeling helpless and numb. They're scared of the changes that we all know will come. Oh, yes, we do. It's got me wondering if we can ever do enough to beat the great turn blue. What else can we do now in the face of this shame? Hold on to each other and don't turn away. Open your vision to see things anew. Keep working together and we'll see how it do. Cause we've got the great turning blues. We've got the great, great turning blues. We've got the great, yeah, 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 great turning blues. Yeah, we've got the great turning blues. We've got the great turning blues. We've got the great, great turning blues.
That was Portland vocalist Barbara Ford singing The Great Turning Blues, and this is the Lifeboat Hour. I'm your host, Carolyn Baker. Tonight we're talking with Molly Young Brown, who is an ecologist, life coach, and an author and close associate and co-author with Joanna Macy. Molly, are you getting any rain up there in Northern California?
Oh, boy. We certainly are. It's wonderful. We've had, I think, 3 or 4 days of that have completely filled up the lakes. The river, the Sacramento River, is running at almost flood levels. It's really quite exciting to finally have some real rain. And of course, there's snow on the mountains, which is important too.
Yeah, and I'm hoping that you don't experience any flooding or landslides.
Yeah, we tend not to have much landslides in this part of the world anyway.
Uh-huh.
Certainly avalanches up on the mountain are probably likely, but flooding could happen. It hasn't,
yeah,
as far as I know.
Well, congratulations on getting the much-needed water. And I don't have to tell you, Molly, that we're facing a time of huge uncertainty about our future. On this show 2 weeks ago, I read Jean Hirschfield's poem, Against Certainty, which I'd like to read again simply because Jean says so well and so succinctly what uncertainty really is. It's a short little poem, and it goes like this. There is something out in the dark that wants to correct us. Each time I think this, it answers that. Answers hard in the heart grammar's strictness. If then I say that, it too is taken away. Between certainty and the real, an ancient enmity. When the cat waits in the path hedge, no cell of her body is not waiting. This is how she is able so completely to disappear. I would like to enter the silence portion as she does, to live amid the great vanishing as a cat must live, one shadow fully at ease inside another. So I believe we face many possibilities, but I do tend to believe that our planet is in a state of hospice. People who speak of the Great Turning say that a transformation might occur that would spare us from extinction. I'm not sure that those two possibilities are mutually exclusive. Sometimes a terminal diagnosis brings forth amazing transformation. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, I couldn't agree more. I've known personally people, and I've certainly read a lot about people who have a terminal diagnosis of cancer and live their final days in an amazing state of grace and bliss, even bliss if they're not in too much pain or if the pain is managed adequately. So, and hospice has been a transformative institution in our culture. It has enabled so many people to deal with their death in a much more a way of much more actual happiness and, of course, going through the grief process as well. But that's part of it. That's part of the happiness, actually. So, we have to overcome our societal denial about the possibility of a near-term extinction, and then choose how we're going to live our remaining days, years, days, whatever it is. It really can be a confrontation that can transform how we live. I certainly don't want to live the rest of my days, in a sort of hedonistic spasm of self-indulgence. I want to live in a way that I feel like I've contributed to the lives of those people around me and done what I could to preserve life on Earth, even if I'm not successful. So that's what I was saying earlier about the Great Turning could happen even as we go down, so to speak. We can go down in ugly, thrashing around and turning against one another, or we can go down, if we do, in love and gratitude and grace. And oddly enough, I think, or paradoxically enough, I think that's the only chance we have to turn things around anyway. If there is any chance, and there may not be, by living in a life-affirming way, we have the most opportunities to prolong life on Earth.
Yeah, we can go down fighting each other or embracing each other. It's really
exactly.
Our choice, isn't it?
Yes, yes.
Yeah. Well, I've been writing about the global crisis for almost 8 years, and in my work with folks, I've experienced repeatedly the transformative power of grief work. And you talk about the importance of honoring our pain for the world. What systems thinking tells us about feedback and pain as evidence of our interconnectedness? And I'd love it if you'd say more about this.
Oh, yeah. When we honor our pain, when we really let ourselves experience it, we realize that it comes because we're interconnected. If we weren't,
right.
If we really were, and I don't know how it would be possible to survive in a disconnected way, but we think we do. But somehow coming to allowing ourselves to grieve what we're losing in our world and what we already have lost is a way of really experiencing our interconnectedness. And as far as feedback, grief or sadness or anger or fear, any of those feelings, usually come because we are reaching a lethal limit. So it's information. So to squelch it is like, if you have a pain in your body and you take a painkiller and kill off the pain, you don't feel it anymore, you don't get the information that something's wrong that you may be able to address and heal. So our pain for the world is important feedback that we need to heed and not pathologize it.
Well, in this culture, you know, we are grief phobic, as Canadian elder Stephen Jenkinson says. And when we do speak of grief in this culture, it's usually in reference to personal grief. And yet personal grief is only one gateway of grief. There are many others. When we were originally planning the show, you suggested the music of Barbara Ford. And as I looked at some of her songs, the one that really leapt out at me was Cry If You Want. And while it supports and validates the tears of personal grief, I'd like us to listen to it with our grief for the planet in mind or in heart. Let's listen to Cry If You Want by Barbara Ford.
Just be here if you want me. There's no use in keeping a stiff upper lip. You can weep, you can sleep, you can loosen your grip. You can frown, you can drown, go down with the ship. You can cry if you want to. Don't ever apologize, venting your pain. Something to me, I don't need to explain. I don't need to know why. I don't think it's insane. You can cry if you want to. The windows are closed, the neighbors aren't home. If it's better with me than to do it alone, I'll draw the curtains and unplug the phone. You can cry if you.
That was Barbara Ford again singing Cry If You Want. And I'm Carolyn Baker, your host of the Lifeboat Hour. And we're talking with Molly Young Brown, who's been working for a number of years with Joanna Macy and who has co-authored The Work That Reconnects with Joanna. Molly, how do folks get in touch with you?
MollyYoungBrown.com. And that's a Y at the end of Molly and a Y at the beginning of Young, so it's two Ys. Another place that I would like to recommend is a website called workthatreconnects.org. And there's lots of information about the Work That Reconnects and various people who are offering workshops and this work around the country, or actually around the world. So that's another good resource for people.
So, Molly, tell us a little more about your own work and what you do, starting with psychosynthesis. You're also a psychotherapist and a life coach, yes?
Yes.
Okay, so you would be one of those priceless and very difficult to find healers with whom people can talk about the craziness they feel on a daily basis, knowing what they know and trying to live in a world that doesn't know and doesn't want to know. Your thoughts on that?
I work on phone and Skype primarily because I live in a very small town, so it's easier to work with people who are all around the world, and they tend to come to me because of my interests in the work that connects and eco-psychology and so forth. So they're people who are, they have issues in their own lives, but they're also struggling to come to terms with the crises in our world. I don't think this is happening so much anymore, but it used to be that if somebody went to a therapist and talked about their pain for the world, they were told that they, are having problems with their father as an authority figure or some such thing. In other words, their pain for the world was pathologized. And I don't think that's happening as much anymore, but I think I'm particularly good at not doing that because I see that personal pain and global pain are totally interrelated. If a person is suffering because they were abused as a child, the lack of support system for parents is partially responsible for that abuse, and consequently it's a social issue as well as a personal issue. So I also like to help people see the systemic influences on them, that what they're suffering is not just their own pathology. If they're having trouble at work or they're working in a job that they're not happy with, it's not just because there's something wrong with them. It's also because the social situation may be toxic. And in recognizing that, it's not to blame and say, oh, well, it's nothing I can do about it. It's actually to empower the person to take steps to either change the situation or get out of it. So helping people see their suffering as part of a larger whole is actually empowering.
Well, you and I do a lot of the same kind of work with coaching and working with people who are so concerned about the global crisis. And yeah, it's true that it's not happening so much as it used to, that psychotherapists would pathologize a person for their anxiety about the global crisis. But, most therapists, and I was trained as a therapist, most were trained to focus on the individual issues as opposed to the cultural issues. So there's still some of this pathologizing or, a suggestion that maybe this is about anxiety or depression and maybe the person needs some medication. And maybe they do. I'm not totally opposed to medication if it's absolutely necessary. But I still think that there aren't a lot of psychotherapists who get the depth of the crisis that we're in and why people are so terribly, terribly disturbed about it. What do you think?
I agree. And there's a whole new field of ecotherapy that therapists are trying to address the situation and recognize that people can be upset because of what's happening in the world around them.
Yeah, one of those is Linda Bazell, and she's been on.
Yes.
Maybe you know Linda. Do you know her?
I don't know her personally, but I know her via the internet, and I participate. She has a Google group called Ecotherapy Association.
I believe
what it's called.
Yeah.
And I participate in that, and often get involved in conversations on that Google group, which it's a really lovely group.
Linda was on the show actually on Mother's Day of this past year. She's one of those who really, really gets it and works with people using ecotherapy.
Mm-hmm.
So you and Joanna talk about the spiral of the work that reconnects, meaning gratitude, honoring our pain, seeing with new eyes, and going forth. Please share more with us about this.
This is something that has actually developed since the first edition of the book came out in 1998, that Joanna began to realize that there was actually this, what she comes to call the spiral. She calls it the spiral because you keep going round, but you go around at a deeper or a higher level, depending on how you want to think about it. So the first step or stage of the spiral is gratitude, and the importance of our starting, our coming from gratitude, especially as we're going to get into the pain of the world, for the world, that we begin with opening our hearts through gratitude and recognizing the blessedness of this life and, as the Buddhists call it, this really incredible privilege of having a human life to live. And then we move actually quite easily into honoring our pain when we start with gratitude, because the pain is right there. What we're grateful for, we also may be mourning. And so we can move into our pain for the world. And probably this would be, I would say, the heart and soul of the work that reconnects. Joanna used to call it despair and personal power, or despair work and personal power. So it's a very, because it's so neglected in our culture, this people want to rush to, well, what's the solution? You got a problem, let's go find the solution.
And what are you going to do about it?
Yeah, what are we going to do about it, rather than just being with the experience and right. and receiving the wisdom from it. And all the feelings of pain for the world, not just grief, but it's also anger, it can be fear, it can be even a kind of a numbness, of just kind of like a blank, I've just given up, I don't know what to do. And all these have a kind of a deeper impact, in a way, a positive side, or what we would see as positive. They're positive, too. But our sorrow is because of our love. If we don't grieve things we don't love.
Yes.
We only mourn what we deeply care about. And we feel fear, but when we speak of our fear, we're showing the trust and courage it takes to speak about our fear in a fear-phobic society. You say we're grief-phobic, we're also fear-phobic.
Oh, indeed.
You're not supposed to be afraid. You're supposed to be strong and tough. And actually, courage is actually when we act even though we're afraid. So you don't take any courage if you're not afraid.
Right, exactly.
And anger is has its source in our passion for justice. And even emptiness is important because it allows space for the new to come in. And this is so important right now. We really do not know what to do.
Right.
We really don't, collectively or individually. And yes, there's this possibility and that possibility of what we'll do this, we'll do that, we'll have a carbon tax, we'll have whatever. But that's all from the conscious mind. And if we can really just let ourselves feel our hopelessness, our emptiness, perhaps in that space, that void, some new perspective can enter and take hold.
And we, in the process, are transformed, you know, and
yeah.
I believe that creates more compassion, more empathy, more connectedness with the earth and each other.
That is the stage of seeing with new eyes.
Yeah, absolutely. And Joanna uses the term bodhicitta, I believe I'm saying it right, which I think is a Buddhist term. And it's a very important term, which I'd love you to define and elaborate on.
It's a term that I'm still learning about from Joanna, but she calls it the intention to act for the sake of all life or all beings. It's a Buddhist, you know, the Buddhists talk a lot about the all beings and dedicating the merit of any act to the benefit of all beings. And by beings, they don't just mean birds and plants and humans. They also mean mountains and rivers and, you know, soil and everything. So bodhicitta is the intention to act on behalf of all life and all beings. It's also our desire for the welfare of all beings. Well, obviously, if we have a desire for the welfare of all beings, then we're going to act for that in that way, even if we don't know what that action is going to be.
Right.
It's holding that underlying intention and allowing ourselves to be guided in the moment by what's before us and what opportunities are there for us to act moment to moment, day to day.
So are there any particular projects that Joanna is planning in the near future? And also, what about your own projects?
Well, basically, Joanna at 85 is appropriately cutting back a little bit on her activities, but she still is offering workshops. I know she's giving a 10-day retreat in June and July, and she'll be putting that on the Work That Reconnects website so people can go there to find out. And she's doing shorter term things too in the meantime, a week, you know, weekend and one day workshops. I'm giving a workshop with a colleague, Constance Washburn, in February. And this is one is sponsored by the Conscious Elders Network, which is a really interesting group that is recently formed to enlist elders in transformational work and projects. So they're sponsoring this workshop because they really want the Work That Reconnects to be at the heart of everything they do. And that's February 13th through 17th, I believe, and it's being held in San Damiano Retreat Center, which is in the East Bay of the Bay Area, San Francisco Bay Area. So people want to know about that, they should go to either my website or the Conscious Elders Network website. And
so,
I will be doing
more
workshops along those lines as the year unfolds.
So give us your website address again, Molly.
Okay, it's no W's. It just is mollyyoungbrown.com.
Okay, very good. And that's Molly with a Y.
Right, Molly with a Y and two Y's, Young and Molly and Young,
Right. Well, I am so happy for you that you're getting rain in Northern California and some snow. May it continue without flooding. And it is so wonderful to have you with us on the show, to be talking to us about your work and Joanna Macy's work. We are truly on the same page. And I just thank you so much and for being here. And I bless you and all that you do. And I thank all of the listeners for being with us. We'll be back again next week.
Thank you so much. I've really enjoyed talking with you and getting to know you better and getting to know your work better. It's very, very, we're on the same page. You're right.
Have a good one, Joanna. Joanna, I said. I meant
you can
Molly.
Call me Joanna if you like. I will. I will. Thank you, Carolyn.
You're welcome.
Chicken cotton for your ribbons and bows. Everybody knows that the dice are loaded. Everybody rolls with their fingers crossed. Everybody knows the war is over. Everybody knows the good guys lost. Everybody knows the fight was fixed. The poor stay poor, the rich get rich, that's how it goes. Everybody knows. Everybody knows the boat is leaking. Everybody knows the captain lied. Everybody got this broken feeling, like their father or their dog just died. Everybody talking to their pockets. Everybody wants a box of chocolates and a long stem rose. Everybody knows.